2004 Salt Lake Sunstone Symposium presents Session 235, Angels in America Revisited, a panel featuring John Charles Duffy, David G. Pace, Albert Eugene Peck, and Michael Evenden.
I write the news section for Sunstone Magazine, and we have a great panel put together. Today, we have John Charles Duffy, who has a degree in English from Brigham Young University and a master's in English from the University of Utah, and has worked as adjunct instructor at the University of Utah writing program, and he is now moving to Chapel Hill in North Carolina to start a PhD on religious studies. He has published at the AML Annual and other literary journals, including a May 2004 Sunstone cover story, Defending the Kingdom, Rethinking the Faith, How Apologetics is Reshaping Mormon Orthodoxy. Elder Eugene Peck really does need introduction. He has made tremendous contributions to the Sunstone Foundation, as has been the editor of Sunstone Magazine for, I think, at least 12 years, right?
15
years. David G. Pace is a Salt Lake-based fiction writer and essayist. He teaches college writing and introduction to film at the Utah campus of the University of Phoenix. And those of you who read Dialogue might have read some of the essays that he has published recently there. The fourth person in this panel unfortunately couldn't make it, but the good news is that he emailed me an insightful essay about 10 minutes long that I'm going to read, and he is Michael Evenden. When Angels in America was first staged, he wrote a review for Sunstone Magazine, and he is an associate professor of theater at Emory University. Now, all the panelists have seen at least two versions, including the HBO recent version of Angels in America. And what we would like to do to begin with is to show just 5 minutes from the HBO version. I have to warn you that there's some adult language, including maybe two instances of the F word. So if you don't feel comfortable, you can leave the room and come back in 5 minutes. But it's just a 5 minutes short that we're going to show.
This is a dream, obviously. I'm sick, and so
having a spectacular dream yourself.
What? Prophet, a moment, please. The disorganization is... He said he hadn't had any. Yes. In the kitchen. Under the tiles. Under the sink.
You want me to tear up the kitchen floor?
With a shovel or an axe or some tool for dislodging tile and root and unearth the sacred implements?
No fucking way! The spirit's dragging up on loose and release!
Don't lose my security deposit. I'll wake up a downstairs neighbor and a hysterical dog and do it yourself.
Submit! Submit to the will of heaven!
This is Mike Evans' remarks as he emailed them to me. A decade after its publication, Tony Kushner's Angels in America remains a remarkable work, both narrowly focused and expansive, disorderly and tendentious, crypto-religious and anti-religious, political and anarchic, full of contemporary American contradictions, but unlike anything else in American drama. It has also had an unusually long developmental life, having started as a commission in an American regional theater, then after various professional workshop phases, including one at NYU performing in London, and then traveling back to the U.S. in a production that began in California and finally landed on Broadway, with Kushner's experimenting with rewrites every step of the way. It was a Broadway version that was published and therefore seemed to take the prize as official version, although even then the published version contained an afterword consisting of a passage Kushner had cut on the road but still wanted to keep in print. Now, 10 years later, that published script lost its finality by being redeveloped as a film that never got made and then, now, into a two-night television miniseries for cable. DVD release of the cable version will make for another de facto adaptation, I'm sure, if there is anything like a director's cut or author's commentary added to the mix. Millennium approaches, but the final form of this play still retreats into the distance. My purpose today is a limited one, to establish some sense of the gradual development of the play through this long process, focusing particularly on the handling of Mormon themes and their evolution, and in that context to point to a small but possibly significant change in the television version concerning the character of Joe Pitt and his mother Hannah. My own view of ancients in America is that the dominant theme is the poverty of orthodoxies, especially authoritarian orthodoxies, and the desperate need for moral life in the form of a modernist, progressive, open-ended exploration and unfettered development of new social and moral ideas. Even though these speeches are electrically critiqued by Lewis, I think that Lewis' speech about the modernist potential of America, the speech that gives the play its title, is crucial to the meaning of the whole. There are no angels in America, Lewis says in his nation's praise, and when the angels do appear, our reluctant prophetic hero Pryor reaches the summit of his calling by rejecting them and their doctrines of stasis. Against that grand theme and the central imagery of what proved to be a dangerous, repressive, out of touch angels, it's no surprise that the faith of the Latter-day Saints, as evoked in the play, is shown to be part of the problem, in allegiance to unchanging belief that traps its adherents. But as the play has morphed over time, is finally not quite that simple, which I believe we can see in the progressive changes in the portrayal of Joe, the married Mormon lawyer exploring his sexuality and his stern but gradually warming up mother, Hannah. My primary sources of information are a series of interviews that Kushner has given and a script of the London version of the play which came into my hands through a friend in high critical circles. In one of the seemingly thousands of interviews Kushner gave in the decade after the play's emergence, the playwright specified that the character of Joe was in his mind from the beginning, when he imagined the play only as a piece about five gay men, one of whom was Ray Cohen and one of whom was a Mormon. That capsule description of what later became a much more expansive dramatic canvas sets out the play's fundamental opposition of gayness and political conservatism, and sets out the personal life as one of the dramatic battlegrounds. What, then, of the playwright's approach to this conflicted character, Joe? That Kushner feels a degree of sympathetic identification with Joe is discernible from his own biography, especially his memories of his own period of struggling against his sexuality, and specifically echoed by Joe in the play, Kushner's awkwardly coming out to his formidable mother over the telephone. But Kushner, unlike many playwrights, can be very tough on characters with whom he identifies. Kushner also once said of Joe, "I was trying to write a conservative character that I could like. In the end, I failed at that." One can see the progress of this failure, if that's what it is, in the progression of the play from the London script versus the later Broadway version of the play as published. In the earlier unpublished draft, Joe's story ends thus. He quarrels with his lover, who has uncovered Joe's previous shadowy collaboration in legal prohibitions of homosexuality. Alone, Joe returns to his wife in a sincere effort to see if he can reestablish their relationship. She clarifies to him that they cannot remain together and leaves. Finally, Joe has a short scene of reconciliation with his mother, in which he describes a dream in which he and she were dancing together against a sky spangled not by stars but by his dead father's military medals, a strange vision of beneficence and resolution of conflict in the home, a kind of final gift to this troubled and abandoned character. In the final, published version of the play on Broadway, however, most of this is altered. In the quarrel with his lover, Joe now turns violent, shouting, "I love you," but literally bashing Lewis in his frustration. Joe's return to his wife is not sincere and self-instigated, but happens at the express instruction of the monstrous Roy Cohn, who tells Joe to return home and fake a marriage. And the final reconciliation with the mother is gone. Clearly, as the writing developed, Kushner felt a need to take a stronger line on this ambivalent character, tying him more closely to Cohen and embodying his personal history of legal prejudice against gays as literal onstage gay bashing. The proration of the writing therefore suggests that Kushner, divided in his feelings about Joe, decided that he needed to get past the ambivalence and provide a kind of summary judgment of the character, holding him sternly responsible for his spiritual love affair with right-wing politics and the suppression of gay rights, denying him a home of comfort at the end. So much then for Joe and the implications of, and by implication, the delusions of Mormonism. Maybe. Interestingly, there are traces of contrasting journeys in Kushner's treatment of Hannah, and through her, his place, ambivalence toward organized religion. Now, in many ways, this doesn't seem like much of an ambivalence. Organized religion, through the implied fundamentalist Christianity feeling Reaganism, through the Orthodox Judaism that fails to comfort Lewis, and through Joe's Mormon faith, is pretty much found in Angels in America to be inadequate or inimical to progress. But a good play is not a diatribe, and possibly even more than the playwright intends, Angels in America comes to offer a very slightly double view of organized religion, at least as personally experienced. Perhaps this is where Kushner's own position as a self-described God-believing Jew comes in. Maybe this is an unconscious result of the development of the character of Hannah, of whom I believe Kushner became increasingly fond as he worked, a fact that may be related to his own mother's passing. In any case, we can also see by comparing the London and the New York scripts a change here, the addition of a few religious elements voiced by Hannah that are not framed by the play's overall spirit of mockery. For example, between the London version and the Broadway script, Kushner added Hannah's quiet, dignified speech about Mormon origins, beginning, "He had a great need for understanding, our prophet." And ending, "It's not polite to call other people's beliefs preposterous." Given the moral authority that Hannah gains in the play by virtue of her kindness to Dying Prior, this is a passage that runs counter to the larger anti-religious statements of the play, and I don't think there are any way to reconcile those opposing streams except as an ambivalence about religion. I'm not an unbiased witness, but I like the ambivalence. I think it enriches the play. There is a hint of room for personal religion, provided it doesn't produce homophobia. With that hint of ambivalence in mind, I was interested to see in the television screenplay a tiny adjustment in the end of Joe's story. After his wife leaves, there is a momentary meeting between Joe and his mother on the street. He tells her the wife has left, the mother muses that the girl will probably be fine, and she promises to cook him dinner back at his apartment. In the television rewrite, then, we get a small echo of the playwright's earlier counter-ending of Joe's story, a touch of mercy, after all, a step back from the final condemnation of Joe in the published play. And for those tracing Mormon references, this little after scene is played against the sound of a street choir, maybe carolers, singing "Shall We Gather at the River?" And before she sees Joe, we hear Hannah quietly join them on the phrase "Gather with the saints by the river." So this moment of reconciliation is played out against the music of religious community. If you ask me what this all adds up to, I would say more ambivalence and welcome. Kushner clearly feels that Joe must be condemned for participating in legal repression of gays and lesbians, particularly because of his own inner sexual promptings, which might have taught him to question right-wing orthodoxy. But just as Kushner can be momentarily sympathetic even to Roy Cohn in his final agony, so he can be to Cohn's disciple Joe, and given the opportunity of the teleplay, he softened the end of Joe's story just a bit, taking one more step in the progression of his contradictory feeling about these two characters and even the faith they represent. Now we are going to hear John Chalcefi.
Let me begin with a disclaimer. I am a raving fan of Angels in America. It is hands down my all-time favorite work of drama. If Tony Kushner walked in that door right now, I would prostrate myself on the floor murmuring, "I am not worthy, I am not worthy." I love Kushner's ear for poetry. I'm amazed at how he's able to use just a handful of actors to create a play that feels epic in scope. And the play's fundamental message, that in this world there is a kind of painful progress, that the world only spins forward, that message resonates strongly with me at a spiritual level. This means that I approached the HBO broadcast with extremely high expectations, unfairly high perhaps. I'm the kind of fan, after all, who can recite the lines along with the actors, and who believes that the 1994 version of Perestroika, not the later revised version, is the one true text. But, for the most part, I was impressed by the HBO adaptation. I appreciated how faithfully the film followed the stage play. I felt that the film successfully bridged the gap from minimalist theater to cinematic realism. And, of course, the cast was outstanding. I have two complaints about the film worth mentioning. Three, actually, but I'm saving the third for later. My first complaint is a tendency towards schmaltz, which especially irks me given that in his playwright's notes for the stage version, Kushner enjoins performers to eschew sentiment. The schmaltz is strongest in the opening scene, the funeral of Lewis's grandmother, where we get Spielberg-esque close-ups and people chuckling together over the rabbi's line, "Eric, this is a Jewish name?" A line I read as reflecting serious annoyance on the rabbi's part over the dilution of American Jewish identity. In the stage version, at least as performed in my head when I read the script, this scene is dark and somber. HBO's version, with its bright, airy look, felt like dumbing down the play to avoid alienating the cable TV audience right off the bat. It got the film off to the wrong start, as far as I was concerned. My second complaint is that the angel is not really as thoroughly amazing as she's supposed to be. Kushner's playwright's notes call for wonderful theatrical illusion. Emma Thompson hanging from a cable with one leg cocked up Peter Pan style might cut it on stage, but it doesn't count as wonderful theatrical illusion on film, although the special effects leading up to her appearance are moderately spectacular. I also did not find HBO's Angel to be as overpowering an erotic presence as she's supposed to be, because the director made the mistake of showing us too much. Prior in the Angel copulating in midair wreathed in fire, or Hannah and the Angel locking lips in midair amidst fireworks probably sounded like great ideas on paper, but on screen in wide shot, they just look awkward. A lot more close-ups would have been sexier. And the wrestling with the angel scene, which the playwright's notes say should be deathly serious, came across as farcical instead. Admittedly, part of the problem here may be that Kushner has written a scene that cannot be acted, because no costume director will allow wrestling actors to damage the angel's wings. Despite his complaints, I felt that HBO made a worthy adaptation of the play, which I will dutifully buy to own on DVD. The hype that surrounded the broadcast also struck me as worthy of this play's stature. The film was pitched to the viewing public as an event, just as it should have been. How does the play represent Mormons? Back in 1996, I read a paper at the annual meeting of the Association for Mormon Letters in which I took issue with Michael Evenden's analysis of Angels in America as published in Sunstone. Evenden complained that Kushner represented Mormonism as an irrelevant joke, a sinkhole of dead values. In Evenden's view, Kushner's use of Mormon motifs constituted an unsympathetic reading of the faith, an elaborate obscene burlesque, comic blasphemy, mockery. Evenden also felt that by excluding conservative Mormons from the utopic space which the play offers in its final scene, Kushner failed to practice the inclusivity he preached. I felt differently. Certainly the play does not present Mormonism in the scripted, coiffed, correlated fashion in which Mormons themselves prefer to present it. And the play is harshly critical of Mormonism's social and theological conservatism. Kushner sees conservative Mormons, conservatives in general, as a threat to the rights and even the lives of gay lesbian people. And since I'm inclined to agree, I'm not particularly bothered by that portrayal. But as I saw it, the most significant connection between Angels in America and Mormonism is Kushner's incorporation of Mormon motifs into what in 1996 I called the play's casserole myth, a postmodern bricolage that weaves elements from various religious or quasi-religious traditions into a single symbolic universe. Mormon motifs like angelic visitation, a sacred book on metallic plates, The Pioneer Trek and the Temple Garment are part of that universe. They contribute to the literary vocabulary in which Krishna expresses his vision of how the world works, his faith and aspirations, his hopes and values. I regard it as a profound compliment that Krishna took our tradition seriously in that way, despite his opposition to Mormon conservatism. And I do believe that Krishna's use of Mormon motifs is fundamentally serious, not mocking, not parodic, not a farce. Krishna himself insists on this in his playwright's notes. Given the discussions that went on in Mormon circles about how Mormonism had been presented in the play, I was intensely interested to see how Mormonism would come across in the film. I was already reconciled to the fact that the Mormon characters don't sound very Mormon. Joe, for instance, talks about God's love in a way that sounds more evangelical Christian than LDS. I figured that was a predictable consequence of Krishna's status as an outside observer. But I hoped that the filmmakers would do the homework necessary to adorn the play's Mormon settings with authentic icons and artifacts, paintings, scriptures, and so on. There was a decent effort in that direction. The set for Hannah's house in Salt Lake City, the books in the background at the visitor center. The Captain Moroni action figures in the visitor center storage room did strike me as oddly chosen. I wasn't sure if that was meant as a satirical commentary on Mormon quirkiness, or if the action figures just happened to be the exemplar of Mormon material culture that the set designers found to work with. In any case, I was pleased that they went looking. It would have been easy to just throw something together based on a preconceived notion of what Mormon spaces must look like, and the result would probably have come out looking more Protestant than Mormon. The temple garments worn by Joe and Harper Pitt were authentic. Like every other Latter-day Saint in the viewing audience, I was keeping a sharp eye out for the marks. Doubtless the display of the garment made many Mormon viewers uncomfortable, even more so perhaps than the moments of nudity or sex. For my part, I'm thrilled by the play's use of the garment as a serious literary symbol, a symbol of Mormon identity. I was less thrilled, and here's my third complaint, by the film's handling of the scene in which the garment figures most prominently, when Joe strips off the garment at the beach to convince Lewis that he'll give up anything to be with him. In the play, Joe removes only the upper half of the garment, so that he is, according to the stage directions, half in, half out of his clothes. I read this as a symbol of Joe's ambivalence about his religious and sexual identity, half in, half out of life as a married Mormon man. And when Lewis redresses Joe, that is, reclothing him in the garment in a kind of reenacted initiatory, I read that as foreshadowing Lewis's rejection of Joe and Joe's attempt to resume his former life. None of this carries into the film, however, where Joe strips himself entirely, bearing his beautifully sculpted buttocks to the viewing audience. It was probably inevitable that the director would throw eye candy at the film's largely gay male audience, but I was disappointed by this way of playing the scene. An intriguing addition to the film, not found in the play, is a scene near the end when Hannah is returning from her vigil at Pryor's hospital bedside and crosses paths with Joe, who's on his way to work after being left by Harper. Evenden described this scene also in his paper that Hugo read. As Hannah ascends from the subway, she encounters a little group of people dressed in Amish-type clothing, singing a hymn. Hannah pauses to watch and joins for a few moments in the singing. Then she sees Joe, who's numb from his rejection by Lewis and Harper. In a kinder tone than we've seen her use with him before, Hannah tells Joe she'll be waiting for him when he gets home. As I watched this addition to the screenplay, I wondered if the new scene was Kushner's attempt to respond to criticisms that Mormons or gay Mormons had directed at the play. The first of these criticisms comes from gay Mormon men dissatisfied with the way Joe's story ended. In the play, Joe is the one character who doesn't have any sense of hope. Pryor goes on living. Harper moves on to a new life in San Francisco. Lewis, despite his betrayal of Pryor, achieves a kind of reconciliation. Even the maleficent Roy Cohn obtains forgiveness. Only Joe remains without a future. Only he remains among the damned. My reading of this is that Joe has committed what, for Kushner, are two mortal sins. First, in returning to Harper after his failed affair with Lewis, Joe has tried to go back instead of moving forward, a sin against nature in this moral universe. Second, and probably even more damning, Joe has betrayed his people, the gay lesbian community, by authoring a court decision that Lewis calls an important bit of legal fag bashing. I wonder if the new scene with Hannah is an attempt to bring Joe in from outer darkness, a suggestion that his story, too, is still unfolding. He has a future to work out, and Hannah is there for him as he picks up the pieces of his life and decides how to move forward. The second criticism that I thought the play, the new scene, might be responding to is Evenden's complaint that in the closing scene of the play, the epilogue at Bethesda Fountain, Hannah appears noticeably different. According to the stage directions, she looks like a New Yorker. Evenden reads this as indicating that Hannah has grown out of her Mormon identity, and he is disappointed by what he sees as the limited vision of Kushner's tolerance, accepting Mormons so long as they agree to leave their religion behind. Consciously or not, Evenden continues, Kushner apes the church's way of accepting homosexuals only when they repudiate their difference, their sexuality. Clearly, at a fundamental level, Kushner is not reconciliatory with those he considers the enemies of his people. End quote. Evenden dreams of a future production of Angels in America where instead of the New York Times, Hannah will appear in the closing scene reading the Bible, carrying an older kind of wisdom with her as she breaks out into new learning. Evenden is correct in pointing out that Kushner's tolerance has its limits. I've noticed something similar about Kushner's notion of forgiveness. Kushner can imagine forgiving a vanquished foe, as Belize says of Roy Cohn, but he seems unable to imagine forgiving an unvanquished foe, which I would suggest is actually the hardest thing. In similar fashion, Kushner doesn't seem able to imagine a utopia that would include both left-leaning gays and Republican Mormons. But then I can't imagine such a utopia either, which may be why I'm less troubled by the limits of Kushner's tolerance than Evenden is. And I disagree with Evenden's suggestion that Kushner is as exclusive toward Mormons as Mormons are toward gays. In a competition over who is the most exclusionary, Kushner or the church comes out the winner, to my mind. Despite its limitations, Kushner's postmodern utopia is more inclusive than any I've seen postulated by Mormon orthodoxy. In any case, I wonder if the new scene with Hannah and the Gospel Street Choir is an effort to respond to the concern that Evenden raises. Is this scene an attempt to mitigate perceptions that Hannah is abandoning Mormonism? Earlier, Belize had articulated a vision of heaven as a messy, diverse metropolis not unlike New York City. I have a hunch that the new scene is meant to show that this metropolitan heaven is big enough for all kinds of people. If the Amish can sing on street corners, and if the Hare Krishna can march chanting down the sidewalk, something we saw earlier in the film, why can't a Mormon find her place here as well? And why can't she work out a life that allows her to move back and forth between the LDS Visitor Center, the apartment of her conflicted Republican son, and the hospital room of a gay man living with AIDS, pausing to sing a hymn with members of another religious group on the way? Is it intentional that the fashionable cape worn by Hannah in the final scene, the one that's supposed to make her look like a New Yorker, is a soft echo of the antique capes worn by the women in the street choir? Is the cape meant to suggest that Hannah still carries her Mormon heritage with her as she integrates herself into the postmodern spiritual community represented in the final scene? A community that in its retelling of the legend of Bethesda weaves narratives and visions from multiple traditions into a single shared story. Like it or not, Angels in America, first the play and now the film, is going to be a significant source for how non-Mormons visualize Mormons, much as Fiddler on the Roof is a significant source for how Mormons visualize Jews. That fact may alarm some Mormons, but I don't think it's such a bad thing. The kind of Mormon who idolizes Ronald Reagan and avoids R-rated movies isn't going to like the way Mormonism is portrayed in this film, but then that kind of Mormon isn't going to like Angels in America for a lot of reasons. I, for one, am proud of Mormonism's presence in this Pulitzer Prize-winning, now Emmy-nominated work. I'm proud that Kushner drew on Mormon motifs in patching together his symbolic universe. I'm proud to see our tradition taken seriously in that way. The fact that Kushner finds much about Mormon beliefs and politics abhorrent makes it all the more striking that he found Mormon motifs worthy to be woven into his postmodern mythology.
Many years ago, when Angels in America was appearing on Broadway, I was on the board of the Association of Mormon Letters. And as we were approaching the annual conference, the person who was the chair of the awards committee came with a request for a policy decision to the board. The person who was the dramatic committee wanted to know whether or not Angels in America should be considered for the Best Mormon Drama Award of that year for the Association of Mormon Letters, which prompted quite a debate among the members of the board of the Association of Mormon Letters. And it was very clear that while they were did not want to say they did not want it to be considered for an award because what were to me very clearly homophobic reasons, that was the reason they didn't want it. But they came up with reasons like, and herein you see the fallacy of awards in general. Well, our awards are really designed to give up-and-coming authors credit, and he just won the Pulitzer, so he doesn't really need our award. And it's not really about Normans, you know, regardless of the fact that three of the characters, and four if you count the angel, the main characters are Norman. There were quite a few other discussions, but when it came to a vote, Norman Angels in America was not to be considered for the award that year, because it was not Mormon. Well, a lot of Mormons saw it, and I saw it a lot of times, because my liberal Sunstone friends would say, well, this is really a serious place. I need to go with a friend who likes theater. I need to go with someone who's Mormon, who can understand the Mormonism, and someone who's gay. So I saw the play in Los Angeles before it went to Broadway, San Francisco, Seattle, Chicago, New York, three times. I don't have a memoir like John Charles, but it's in my system. And the question is this play Mormon? That's not a bad question to ask. Which of your Back to Mormon letters, this kind of question is a poem written by a Mormon that has nothing to do with Mormonism, is that a Mormon poem? It's a poem written about Mormonism by a non-Mormon, is that a Mormon poem that we should consider in granting awards? Well, I can testify that friendly non-Mormons get plenty of awards at the Association of Mormon Letters. It's the only place that they're not sure they like the message, which wins it. Once, when my colleague at Sunstone, Brian Cagle, and I were in Manhattan, we were browsing through the Village Voice, finding something to do, and we saw that Toby Kushner was lecturing down at NYU. So we caught a cab and rushed down there and heard him lecture at the Jewish Community Center for Students at NYU, the Jewish Institute at NYU, filled with a bunch of old ladies passionately querying him about the Jewishness of the Mormons in America, with the same obsession about how he dealt with their Jewish culture, the same way we're dealing with how we dealt with our Mormon culture. It took like an hour before someone asked him, what about the Mormons in the play? To which he outlined how he came to get to know Mormons, which he said was while he was here at a Sundance workshop. But we came very clear from his comments, he did not know much about Mormons. He was not like Jan Schiff, someone who really knows us from the inside of our skin and making a commentary about us. He's clearly an outsider looking at us and telling us what he sees as an outsider. That's just a description. That's a fine thing to be. He's not Cal Grondo inside our skin doing a cartoon. So on one level, Mormons in America is not really a Mormon play. That tells us a lot about Mormonism if we want to get to some of the nitpicky points. And Kushner doesn't really pretend to be doing that. He is writing a play about conservative America, religious conservative America in the Reagan years. And he is using Mormonism as a metaphor to make that point. And to some degree, you know, as I watched Hannah, Meryl Streep in the movie, she did not feel like a Mormon to me at all. She felt like a Midwest conservative evangelical stoic Protestant, you know, which probably much easier for Kushner to create that kind of person. And the point that Kushner is making about conservative religious culture in Reagan America was that their message is wrong. Their message is stop, do not go forward, go back. And he's using the Mormon characters to make that point. And we're the only religious people, you know, other than the Jewish characters in the play. So we're representing all of evangelical America, not just Mormonism in that play. Still, as anyone who's watched Channel 11, KBYU, tout the latest addition to the family programming program, which already included my three sons and Perry Mason, and the new addition was I Love Lucy. There was something to be said about the message, go back, applying to Mormonism. Go back to the 1950s is basically the message of KBYU. And that is a message of Mormonism. So Tony Kushner is right in saying that that applies to Mormonism. On the other hand, I've observed in this process of being with Sunstone for so many years to see many Mormons deal with the main premise of his response of his play, which is, we must go forward, the earth spins forward, we cannot go back, even if we do not have a theory to tell us what we need to do, we must go forward with the experience that we have. I've seen the most conservative Mormons deal with that with their gay children. I've seen plenty of other Mormons deal with that on other issues. It is the modern issue that we have to deal with. And when they asked Hannah in the movie, you know, what do you do when the theory doesn't work? Her answer is, well, you have to go forward, you know, without it. And that is an inspiring answer, which the most Orthodox Mormon could sing Lead Kindly Light and believe that the doctrine too. So Tony Kushner is writing about Mormonism. He's not wrong in what he sees of us as an outsider, and we should take what outsiders see. Those of you who read Dialogue might have read Doug Tobler's letter in a recent issue where he said, we only need to learn from people who have a testimony of this gospel. What do outsiders have to tell us? Outsiders like Jan Shipps have to tell us. Well, outsiders have a lot to tell us that we can't see ourselves. And in spite of his making a political message using Mormons as the type and the symbol, he does tell us a lot about Mormonism, which we can and should take to heart. I think the Association of Mormon Letters should have considered and probably should have given the award to Tony Kushner that year. It was a play about Mormonism in spite of its larger political, philosophical agendas. But we should not become too obsessed on whether he gets every little detail right about Mormonism, because that is not the point he is trying to make. Still, it's a good tool for us to ask those kind of questions about us, and we can learn from that conversation. Thank you.
What I want to know is, if I'm the only straight guy up here, why am I the only one that wore my muscle shirt?
Maybe you're not straight.
Cheryl? That's such a typical gay response. No. I just have some short prepared comments and then maybe riff for a bit. I have quite a history with this play as well. I actually, for one reason or another, ended up friends with Frank Rich at the New York Times. He was the theater critic there, and he knew that I was Mormon. And when this play opened in London, I read something that he had written about it. He would prostrate himself in front of Tony Kushner as well, along with John Charles. And so I flew to London to see this show, and it was only the first half was up. The second half hadn't even been finished. So that's where it started, and I had a very profound emotional response to it, personal response to it. Had very little to do with a lot of the issues we're talking about, other than identity. I was struggling with my own identity as a Mormon, and I'd never seen Mormons on a professional stage. And I was bowled over. And I don't think it's because the characters were particularly nuanced, Mormon characters. I don't think they're particularly nuanced. I think it said more about the fact that we don't have Mormon characters out there and that we're willing to identify with anything, you know. And for me, it was, you know, I argue that there is an ethnic identity to Mormonism, and I consider myself an ethnic Mormon. My much as a Jew might who converts to Christianity, or snacks on prosciutto, or but we don't. We manipulate sometimes, and we go in there and bus Relief Society sisters to sink the ERA, and make, you know, the church makes its statements, and we are players in the sense that we have presence in terms of numbers. But this is the first time that, you know, literally that I saw Mormons speaking to the other participants in the American social political conversation and being respectable. So for that, in and of itself, I thought that was worthwhile. I was on assignment with the New York Times when this show came out, thanks to Frank Rich. And in fact, you know, so I went to this screening. It was, the story was supposed to be about the screening and the potential backlash, because this is right after John Krakauer got basically told that he was a hack writer by the church. And so I wrote it, and they didn't publish it. But I have to say this as an aside, it's the most, they gave me a kill fee. It's the most money I've ever been paid for anything I've ever written. So I'm going to read this to you, and I have copies if you'd like it. Spread it around. It's copyrighted, though. Mormons and their conservative faith, considered by many to be homophobic, were the perfect foil for playwright-screenwriter Tony Kushner's show about gays, AIDS, and the Reagan era. Referred to by sociologist Thomas O'Day as America's only indigenously-derived ethnic community, Mormons, nevertheless, are mainstream enough, according to University of Utah professor Colin McDonnell, to quote-unquote pass in the hegemony of white, mostly male, American power structures. Enter Joe Pitt, played by Patrick Wilson, the Republican lawyer from Utah who is a closeted gay and acolyte to Roy Cohn, Al Pacino. And you have the match in a tinderbox that is Angels in America. HBO Films worried about their own tinderbox when the Salt Lake Film Center first asked to preview both parts of Angels in this city, where the Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints is headquartered. They looked at us and they said, "You want to do what?" says the center's managing director, Catherine Toll. Though Angels was partly workshopped at the 1990 Sundance Playwrights Lab in the mountains east of here, the church, which aggressively proselytes, is a main player in sinking same-sex marriage legislation across the country and a fierce defender of its family-oriented public image. There was no backlash to the screening, but the consequences of Angels within and without Mormondom are potentially considerable. For one thing, Mr. Kushner's work is largely driven by the faith's sacred stories, themes, and iconography, including the angel itself, a wild re-imaging of the angel Moroni, which made a first appearance in the bedroom of Joseph Smith in 1823. Salt Lake City is a focus of prophecy, says Marie Fremer, 59, referring to the line of church presidents revealed by the faithful as prophets. An ex-Mormon and lesbian, Ms. Fremer works at the Gay and Lesbian Community Center of Utah, one of the co-sponsors of the November 8th screening. Prophecies here, quote, say that the end of times is going to be horrible, bloody, and bad, forerun by people who were deviant sexually, she says. Another, more inclusive interpretation of the end times came across to us in Angels, unquote. 56-year-old Bob Nelson, for some reason the New York Times has to have everybody's age in there, department chair of theater and media arts at Church-owned Brigham Young University in Provo, and a devout Mormon himself, likewise admires Angels, but for a different reason. For Mormons, there's never been anything like Tony Kushner Angels in America, he says. It jars us out of our comfort zones, demands that we enter actively into the world of ideas and causes, and calls us to action. He also, unquote, he also appreciates the attempt of the show to portray Mormons as deeply shaded characters. While other ethnic groups have entered media culture, Mormons have somehow been left out. Unless one counts 19th century caricatures of venal polygamists or something like the walking gags in Trey Parker's irreverent 1998 Orgasmo, the church and its most Orgasmo, period. The church and its most loyal have stereotyped their own in film and on stage as sanitized heroes and Pollyannas, ignoring, even punishing, efforts of some to create more faceted work. In the controversial Angels, a new kind of Mormon makes its cultural debut, flawed, plucky, neurotic, faithful, and, in the case of Joe, gay. Joe's predicament isn't a new one for Richard Cotino, 45. Excommunicated for homosexual behavior, he now lives with his partner in a Salt Lake suburb, situated just below the towering Wasatch Range. Both describe growing up gay in similar terms to others, but they also attest to the added agony of being part of a family unit destined in Mormon theology to continue in the hereafter, but only if each member remains faithful. Quote, "You're not able to go on with your family in eternity," says Mr. Cotino, one of six children. "Who you are diminishes the entire family," unquote. While the couple identified with the characters and angels, they feel that the devout will exclude themselves from it, fearing social censure. Some of the devout, however, have embraced angels, which for the first time in mainstream culture has positioned Mormonism as part of the pantheon of world faiths. Many find it liberating to see themselves in portrayals that transcend the church's control over how it looks to be Mormon. Quote, I wish you would be more true to your demographic profile, says Pryor Justin Kirk to Joe's mother, Hannah, played by Meryl Streep, who has clearly left her comfort zone to take a strange gay man dying of AIDS to a Manhattan hospital. "I want to be a woman like that," says assistant professor of theater Megan Sanborn Jones, 31. Hannah is, quote, "moving to me, someone I can identify with," unquote. Even though she says everyone in her view should see Angels, the Seattle native who also works at BYU does not include the play in her undergraduate curriculum for fear of alienating her students, whom she refers to as sheltered. Hugo, forgive me if I pronounce your last name wrong. Saying this, thank you. 39, sorry, Hugo, I had to tell. A third generation Mormon from Argentina and gay sees such sheltering as partly a product of the church's determination to see not homosexuals but individuals, quote, with same-sex tendencies, unquote. Quote, "The politics of denial that the church is engaged in has put us in a very difficult situation," says the Associate Director of Affirmation and Organization for Gay and Lesbian Mormons, John Charles Duffy, 31, Mr. Salinas' partner of 4 years, puts the dilemma of Mormon gays perhaps most succinctly. Quote, "Being gay and Mormon are fundamental parts of my identity, even though they are in tension." Gay or straight Mormons and even non-Mormons interviewed at the screening agreed that the most prickly part of the use of Mormonism in Angels is its display of the sacred temple garment, worn as underwear by the devout. Outside the church's most recent general conference in October, evangelical street preachers protesting the church's false, quote-unquote, false doctrines used the garment as symbolic toilet paper in front of the faithful, leading to a brief fracas and an arrest. Even though in Angels the use of garments which appear genuinely patterned seemed respectful to the uninitiated, believers often felt uncomfortable by the suggestion of their intimate ritual lives if not betrayed. While the official church has stated they do not comment on commercial works like Angels, aggressive action against what they view as unfair representations of the church and its adherents is not unprecedented. Author John Krakauer was targeted last June as essentially a hack and a preemptive attack on his most recent book, Under the Banner of Heaven, An Interpretation of Mormon History. And filmmaker Neil LaBute has reportedly been disciplined by local leaders for Bash, an off-Broadway hit that was later taped for Showtime. Even Richard Dutcher, the darling of the current surge in Mormon cinema, Riley termed Mollywood, has taken heat from some of his brethren for crafting characters with flaws that range from vulgarity to murderous psychopathy. Quote, "The only thing that I would have liked to know is what happens to Joe in the end," says Danny Schoenfeld, 25, a business consultant who grew up in Utah and, despite Mormon friends, concedes that, quote, "you can never be truly a part of their community," unquote. Continuing to quote, "you never really see how his, as Joe's religion and the private life get resolved, unquote. He says, referring to the last sighting of Joe in the film in which he disappears into the darkness of a New York subway entrance, was there a resolution? That is a question many Mormons are asking of angels, as their largely veiled subculture, anchored by an increasingly powerful church, is granted a new pair of wings. For someone like Shar Nelson, 54, who was married to Mr. Nelson and a playwright herself, the Salt Lake screening took her on a personal flight that was, in her faith's own parlance, its own revelation. "I can't get around it religiously," she confesses, still wondering in a phone interview why she did not walk out of the film that by every standard she's been taught was offensive. The mother of four considers a biblical metaphor: if you're engaging in something that bears good fruit and brings you closer to God, something that is moral and good, then I think that the source is good. The feeling I had at the end was a good one. Holy.
We have about 18 minutes for comments or questions. Please come to the mic so that it gets in the cassette version.
Well, I too would prostrate myself before Krishna. I'd just like to make a couple of detailed comments. One is about what I think is the strength of Hannah and Harper also. Harper is not usually given much attention, and to me she's very significant. But I do think he implies that both these women, even Harper in her skitsy way, draw on Mormon tradition and Mormon strength and Mormon background. I don't think Hannah could have moved. I mean, I think you can get this reading, at least, that Hannah could not have moved forward if she didn't have that foundation of Mormon strength, pioneer almost strength. Another is that I think the scene, it was a lot better on the stage, I thought, than in the film, but the scene in the Mormon Visitor Center in Manhattan is one of the greatest satirical, I mean, it's marvelous, and any Mormon who can't laugh at that is in a bad way. And thirdly, just the detail of the Roy Cohn's death scene, when he is being forgiven, almost without intentional forgiveness, by Ethel. I just think that's one of the most powerful, and not sentimental, but truly powerful moments in it. One of the real high points. And I think it, along with some other things in the play, enlarges it way beyond just the homosexual issues in it, that it really takes us on a spiritual high. And anyway, I love this play, and thank you for doing it.
Paul has a comment or a question.
Well, I want to say that I agree with Marion about both Hannah and Harper. And Hannah, you know, Albert's comments about is she Midwestern Protestant, really, in her portrayal? Is there anything essentially Mormon there? I not only felt that she felt Mormon to me, she reminded me of my dead sister-in-law, I once had a fascinating argument with about feminism on my brother and her front porch once, and she asked questions about what's this feminism about? What's that about? Interestingly enough, she was in her own life, my sister-in-law, that is, a terrifically active writer type person, always out in the community doing stuff. She was, in essence, the way she lived, a feminist, and she didn't you know, she didn't quite see her place in all of that, but she, as she was moving forward. But anyway, Meryl Streep, and maybe it's just because I love Meryl Streep, but I saw her as Mormon in the film in many ways and moving through some stuff about who she was. The portrayal of temple garments, I thought, was brilliant in that I you know, for the first time, their significance became apparent to me in a way that was dramatic and real and was nuanced and that had not become apparent to me when I wore them. So I thought it was very subtly done. For anyone who doesn't know anything about it, it would have been a respectful treatment, it seems to me. Not a big deal was made of it. You noticed they were there. I do a 10 best list every year, and I broke all the canons of correct movie going and movie criticism law by putting. I regard it as a film, even though it wasn't released theatrically. I put it second on my list, in America first, Angels in America second. A terrific film. This discussion has been incredible. I was unfortunately session hopping between Phyllis Barber's session and this one, but I got to hear both Phyllis and David, which was my main. And I'm sorry I missed you. Yours, you go.
Five
or
six.
Yeah, as if I didn't know. Yeah. Okay, anyway, thank you.
Thank you, Paul. Mike, can you come to Mike?
Ten years ago, I made a special trip to New York City only for the purpose of seeing Angels in America, and I scheduled it the way they had it available to see it on a Tuesday, and then I saw the second part on a Thursday night. And my greatest surprise relates to a comment that that John Charles made about the audience for Angels in America, and then my greatest disappointment relates to Hannah. My great surprise was I came into the theater expecting to see nothing but gay males and a few lesbians, something similar to what I've seen in most GLBTI socials and gay bars I've been to. And I was stunned when I walked into the theater and began seeing people filing in that this was a typical Broadway audience. I mean, there were married couples, there were couples with children, I saw couples with 8-year-olds, I saw couples with teenagers who were in hand attending as a family, a lot of older couples, the kind of audience that I had become accustomed to in other visits to New York seeing. And so I don't know if there's been any demographic study of the audience on the Nielsen ratings for the audience that saw the HBO series, which I haven't seen yet myself. But the New York audience was a typical New York audience. I was stunned at that. My big disappointment was in the play, and again, I don't know how this is handled, if it's handled in the same way in the HBO, because I didn't see that, or at least I haven't yet. But I was deeply disappointed in one scene in the Hannah character, who I agree is one of the most lovable, one of the most endearing characters of the play, where in Salt Lake, before she has her trip to New York, she sneaks a cigarette. And I thought, this is so weird that Tony Kushner cannot acknowledge a religious person without showing feet of clay. I mean, I was very disappointed in that, because I thought that was so alien to what is true of religious people, that not all religious people are hypocrites, not all religious people have feet of clay, that religious people have flaws, and yet the way that that was presented was very disappointing to me. But on the whole, that experience that I had of those two nights was wonderful, and I thoroughly enjoyed the play and the experience. I saw it, at least half of it, here in a Salt Lake Theater production about 2 years after that, which I enjoyed. It wasn't, it didn't have all of the professional trappings of the Broadway production, but I enjoyed it here too. Anyway, those are my reactions.
Have you seen the film version?
No, I have not.
Have you seen where she takes the drag on the cigarette? It has been cut.
Oh, good.
I'm wondering if maybe because of concern.
I'm pleased as punch. I'm happy as a clam about that then, because I found that the only disappointment in the play was that scene.
Question. Okay.
A little bit. When we're here, we're preaching to the choir. And what I would like to know is whether your families or conservative friends, whether you felt this play made a difference. Would they see it? Did they see it? How do they respond? There aren't a lot of arch-conservatives here to tell me.
Anyone would like to comment? Perhaps anyone from the audience would like to comment how their friends or families saw the play, if they found it offensive or misrepresenting Mormonism.
I'd like to say one short thing. When I was writing this article, I interviewed a lot of people, and one person who will remain nameless to protect her identity called me up in a panic after she told me stuff on the phone and said, I'm headed off to my young women's group and I've been thinking about what I'm saying, and you know what, if when I think of seeing their little faces and telling them what I'm going to tell them tonight about what's important in this life, I can't reconcile what I've just told you. And I really don't know if I want to be in this article. And I think that's actually more typical than we'd like to think. I think that there is a real fear of looking beyond what the church controls in terms of especially our public image. It's okay about what we, how we see ourselves in the ward house, but once it gets out there and it represents the Mormon group, then people, I've argued elsewhere that we don't lie for the Lord, we're not missionaries, every member a missionary anymore, it's every member a publicist.
Perhaps one could add that many Mormons perhaps do not have a cable TV, or they have cable but they don't have necessarily HBO, so this is a process, and next month when the DVD version is out, I think many more Mormons will be exposed to it.
That is one drawback to the play. I mean, Kushner's work is highly and explicitly political, and one risk of that is that you do end up preaching to the choir to a very large degree. In the case of Angels in America, because it does have strong sexual content, because it has strong profanity, I mean, that in and of itself, I think, alienates a lot of potential LDS viewers and will keep a lot of LDS people from seeing it.
Any other comment or question for this session?
My second son was 2 months away from his mission and had just been called, and we sat down and watched together the entire production, and this is a typical sheltered Utah boy, and it was a fantastic experience. It was enlightening, it was embarrassing at times, but ultimately, a tremendous spiritual experience.
And he still went on his mission.
On his mission now in Chicago and having a wonderful.
On that note, thank you for everyone for coming and for our wonderful panelists.
I don't know how you look like. I don't know how you look like.